All right, we're off. Welcome, hello to the first freebooters that's not on YouTube.
Oh, the first preview, yeah, that's not on YouTube at all.
So there we go. Although, to be honest, one of the things I've noticed, and I don't know if I've mentioned this on freebooters yet, I might have on the last one, but the freebooters channels get picked up as podcasts. So you can go into like AntennaPod or whatever your podcast reader is, and just listen and slash watch Freebooters as a podcast.
Coming
So,
from,
as in
coming
like you
from.
can, yeah, pulling from the PeerTube,
Oh, putting the feature. Oh, that's cool.
yeah. So it's because like basically podcasting is kind of the one of the few sort of genuinely decentralized mainstream.
It
Plat.
yeah. It still is like that's still correct, but it is. They're trying. You know, the platforms are trying very hard to bring it on board.
Is that going to be an inevitability? Like, if Fediverse like makes it mainstream, are there going to be? Is Meta going to try and make the well, the biggest? I say Meta as in like they've already done their Fediverse sort of offering, haven't they? But have they given up on it? I haven't heard much from them really
If
these days.
if Fediverse ever becomes the norm, and more people are on Fediverse than are on any particular platform, then yeah, they'll add Activity Pub and they'll manipulate it so they are, you know, yeah.
So it's, I don't know, are we forever to be on the fringes of the internet? Probably, but who cares? It's a nice fit, you know.
Well, I mean, the advantage of that is if we're going to have these siloed platforms, then at least they're interoperable. And you can reasonably be outside of them while still, if you want to, engaging with them in some way. I mean, I'm sure they'll shut down that as much as possible, but yeah.
I mean, things as they are now aren't terrible. Like I Fedi's the only social media that I really use, and I get what I want out of it. It doesn't take over my life in the same way that, you know, the others try
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
so, you
I think
know.
I've said this before, but and I would never was a user of social media. And I didn't enjoy Twitter, didn't enjoy Facebook, I never took part in them, but I enjoy Fedi. So for me, it's not like a replacement at
No.
all. It's just
No.
not a different thing that I. Yeah, Fedi feels more like what internet forums used to feel like back in the 90s, a bit.
A bit, but also there's only one. I don't know. There's not. It's not like this. I don't know. I mean, there's like. Is Fedi one thing? It depends, doesn't it? Right? Like, if you're on like
Yeah,
a.
no. It's not like the forums in that sense, but it's like the forums. Like on Twitter, I'm sure you can have a discussion on Twitter, but on Twitter, it's that virality is the driving factor behind everything. So the things that win are like the witty one-liner type, or the insults, or the polarized, I hate this group, I hate this group kind of posts. Whereas on Fedi, because we don't have that algorithmicness, the conversations I have on Fedi. Because I don't actually post much, I boost stuff and I comment, and the comment threads are actually they're proper discussions, they're proper respectful. We're all in this together, we're all on the same side, kind of a discussion, disagreement for sure, but reasonable disagreement, not for show disagreement.
Exactly, yeah. Like I've never like as much as I've disagreed with people on Fedi, I've never felt that they were insincere. And I like that's kind of important, you know, that's because you know, I mean, you're never gonna.
I think disagreements, even if it's a disagreement that is insurmountable, they end with agree to disagree rather than look at this fucking idiot.
Exactly. Like, you know, and I mean, I change my opinion enough that I don't ever try and get too bogged down on it. Like, I mean, I've been on the been it, I've not changed massively. Like, I think one of my solidified views is this rooted in sort of left wingism, whether be it socialism or whatever, was having my appendix out when I was quite young, and I was like, God, if I had to pay for this, I'd be fucked. And kind of things like that kind of slid. Like, I don't think you could ever move me away from socialized healthcare, really, you know, or anything like that. Yeah, maybe you could tweak around the edges. Maybe it'd be best if it done this way, but this way, etc. But like, at the end of the day, it to me, it just seems weirdly barbaric to like even just like deny people life-saving healthcare.
Barbaric is the right word. Yeah, you know, when you especially if you know when you look at America, like richest country in the world, clearly have the resources to give healthcare, food, basic living standards to everybody in that country, and actively choose not to.
Yeah, it was pretty. Yeah,
it's barbarism. Yeah, socialism or barbarism.
I've only got one thing that I thought we would talk about today, but I know it's going to be like very similar to the conversations we've had in the past. But Mozilla are dropping Pocket, and I'm just kind of thinking, you were never going to make it work. Why did you even bother in the first place? Like, what's the point?
Yeah, Pocket. I mean, the only response is tell Supri.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, stop trying to make Pocket work. And they really tried, because I remember, like, they started out by, oh, it's just an official add-on, and then they made it harder and harder to, like, uninstall Pocket to the point where it was just, like, embedded into the browser. It's like, no.
It's very Mozilla in several ways. Firstly, it was never good.
No.
Like, if they made it good, then that would have been cool. Secondly, it was never like, if it made it open, like you could use your own server and you plug in the details, it made it like the glue that sticks these things together and you can decentralize it or whatever. That would have been cool. And most importantly, I think it's very Mozilla in that how many people really use a thing like Pocket?
Very few. I don't know anyone.
It's a vanishingly small proportion of people who use anything. I mean, I think Ghosty uses something along those lines, but and also the kind of users who are going to use something like that and never going to use a proprietary thing like that.
Exactly.
Wing has, he was showing it off the other day. He has a thing for collecting bookmarks and stuff. But it's his own thing on his own server, you know, and he does it in his own way. So the kind of users who are going to do that something like that are going to have requirements that aren't met by a proprietary thing, and secondly, vanishingly small proportion of users are going to do that anyway.
Yeah, but also like they have the syncing bookmarks. Like they to me, Pocket largely does what the bookmarks manager is supposed to do, right?
I think it still sort of advertises, when I say advertises in inverted commas, like presents itself as a read offline type thing. But who's offline these days? Is it not that type of service? I thought it was.
I thought it was I didn't realize it was
like a save for later type thing.
A save for later, but not like necessarily offline.
But why save for later if not offline? I mean, how is that distinct from
exactly? Well, what, I mean, who would use Pocket? I don't know. This is the reason why no one's using Pocket. So I don't know. RIP Pocket, I guess. Like,
yeah. Does anybody care? Replies to the email addresses up there.
Oh, no, we don't have the. Videos.
You'll watch another video, the email address is up there.
We have comments down there. You find us on the Feddy. You know where we are. And if you're listening to this on AntennaPod, well, just yell it out the window of your car or whatever.
Ghosty reminded me the other day that on one episode, you know that three words thing that gives you a location?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I think we were looking at that, and I gave mine, and I didn't realise it was basically down to, like, a metre square, so...
You can proper dox yourself.
Send me a letter.
Yeah. I quite like that as an idea, although there have been, like, reported problems, because emergency services use it, and... Yeah. If you get like one word slightly wrong, it just sends you off because the thing about it is that it's very algorithmically done to make it like, I think, unreproducible, because this is full capitalism, right? Someone's come up with a really good idea, right? You've got three words, you can describe it down to a 3x3 meter square in the universe, like not in the universe, on the planet. You can do it in the universe.
Oh, no, that's not true.
But the trouble is, they're super litigious, and there have been like open source variants of it, but they've been shut down because what three words basically just want to be the only name in town. And they're making like, I don't know if they're making formal partnerships with emergency services, but emergency services obviously find them useful enough to use. And you know, you hear about stories and stuff about how like kids are like saving their parents' life because they've managed to work out how to use what three words. And it's like, that's a great idea, but partly it's made worse by their desire to like privatize the system, and even worse still by being particularly litigious about it, because it could be better. There could be like words could be grouped by theme or something like that, so that even if you get it slightly wrong, or words sounding similar could be grouped, like homophones and things like that. But they don't do that because that would make it too easy to replicate, I guess. But there is...
It does make me wonder, what's wrong with the address system? Why aren't addresses good enough?
Well, UK...
out in the wilderness, of course, you don't have an address. I understand that, but...
Well, my parents have a house in Greece that doesn't have an address.
Why not?
Because, I mean, Greek people are kind of...
Failing that, why not just longitude and latitude?
Yeah, that does the... well, it's harder to convey on words. Like, how do I... It's like, oh, where are you right now? I'm in Albatross Lift Cudgel. You know, like...
But then you have to go through a sort of a reverse process to work out where that you can't... If all you've got is that, say the internet went down, and all you've got is that, you're fucked.
Yes.
Whereas if you've got a longitude and latitude or an address, like it seems like so addresses have worked for a very long time
in the UK.
In the places that have places that don't have them should do them rather than come up with a different system. And also capitalism coming wrong and sort of like it's a failure. Of this, because the state has been defunded, so the state should fix. If this system is no longer meeting our modern needs, fix it like we used to.
Yeah,
don't let a capitalist company come in and provide a solution that only they can provide and is cool, but it seems like a weird and I don't know quite what I'm trying to say.
So it's
so far away from, rather than being built upon what we have, it's completely aside from it. That's the thing. Yeah.
I don't know if it translates latitude and longitude into words.
That's human parts, right? How else?
Yeah, and also when you go on What Three Words, the website, it does give you a option of doing coordinates, so you can convert the three words into coordinates. But
I'm thinking in terms of emergency use, like a website that tells you your longitude and latitude, which you can read quite easily to the emergency services. That doesn't seem particularly harder than the three words or whatever.
So a good app or Google Maps. Does Google Maps do that? I don't
know.
Is my phone about... there it is. I don't know. I've got organic maps on my phone. I'm just going to check to see how quickly it takes me to to find the nearest jar of piss. Sorry. to find my... sorry, Otis is bothering me. He's worked out that I'm talking to inanimate objects again and thinks I'm a bit crazy. So it's like, go on, talk to me.
Trying to give you comfort. Yeah. I'll come and listen to you.
Right. So it's found my location. Oh, he's beautiful. How do I right? Share my location. Here we go. Well, it's given me an OpenStreetMap link.
Yeah.
Okay. What if
that,
I?
That probably has a longitude and latitude in it, right? As
almost certain. Let's have a look. Right. I need to put it into a browser. I'm sure there's a quick way of doing that. But okay. All right. Put it into my browser. And what do we got? Oh, it has actually the longitude and latitude is in the URL.
Yeah.
And then okay, all right, so that's like it could, I mean,
the difference is that the three words is memorable, as opposed to remembering a string of what is it, like at least six numbers.
It's like six, not six, but like 16 numbers. It depends how precise you want to be.
Yeah, I'm just looking on Google Maps to see if it's if the longitude and latitude is visible anywhere. But I can't see it.
Google have their own thing. They have Google have plus codes.
Plus codes?
Yeah, which is actually an open source.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. I think if you go, there's a website for it. Hang on a minute. I can do. There we go. Right. Plus codes.
So, there
we go. Plus codes. There we go. Addresses for everyone. What are plus codes? Plus codes are like street addresses for people or places that don't have one. Instead of addresses with street names and numbers, plus codes are based on latitude and longitude and display as numbers and letters. With a plus code, people can receive deliveries, access emergency and social services, or just help people find them. Why plus codes? Open source and easy to use. Plus codes is open source and free to create and use. They are much shorter than traditional global coordinates, so they're easy to share.
Okay, I think I prefer that. Is that reverse translatable if you know how it works?
I think
the worst
so.
Thing is, obviously, it's not reversible, is it?
No. It does it based on city. So they've got here, so you've got an example is like PR7G plus J2 Nairobi is one of the ones they've got as an example. Which I guess is shorter. But also there is what free words, which is the open source.
Yeah, I remember that one, yeah.
What three words? Has it been shut down yet? I think it might have actually. What free words? Oh my God, it's been scrubbed from DuckDuckGo.
I mean, I imagine if they've got a patent on the idea, then yeah, very easy
yeah,
to shut that
but,
down because they're doing exactly the same thing. But that takes me back to, it's just the fact that we accept the privatization of all these things these days. And it is as stupid as what if the address system was privatized, you know, back in the day when whoever first came up with the idea of addresses and it's like, oh, you got to pay me a license fee if you want to use a fucking address. Or, you know, private, like privatizing or proprietizing that just language, you know, it's stupid.
Yeah. Did you know this is okay? So I know you don't like this guy, but CGP Grey did a video about address systems around the world, I think. And he was talking about how, like, address systems today, they're based on like old, you know, like postal routes and stuff like that. But today, with technology, internet, computers in our hands, and all that kind of stuff, apparently Ireland have updated their address system so that not only is like, so they give you like a string, I think it is, but I think when you move, you can take your address with you.
Oh, I don't like that. That's silly. Why would you do that?
Let me check. Let me check.
That's not like Americans and their number plates and phone numbers. American mobile phone numbers are associated with you rather than the phone. But to be fair, I see the value of that one, but the number plates one is weird. Like your number plates are yours, not your car's.
I'm just gonna check it. So Ireland was the last country in the OECD to create a postcode system. Unlike other countries where postcodes define clusters or group of addresses, an IR code identifies an individual address and shows exactly where it is located. The system was criticized at its launch. okay, maybe I'm wrong on the it can move.
Okay, good, because that's silly.
I'm sure someone will correct us one way or t'other. It consists of 7 characters. The first 3 characters, called the routing key or the routing key, are designed to benefit the postal and logistics industry and contain an average of 15,000 addresses each. The routing key is used to help sort mail. It is the principal post town of the address as defined by AN Post, AN Post, state-owned, that you know, postal service.
Yeah.
The second part of the IR code is called the unique identifier, consisting of 4 characters drawn from a set of randomized letters and numbers that identify each individual access. They are stored in a central database along with other useful geographic information, including addresses, variants and aliases, and geo-coordinates of each address point. Oh, okay, so it's database-based.
Yeah, so it's a normal, that's a normal postcode then, essentially.
I think so, but it's like, I don't know, more based around modern technologies and stuff, or ways of doing things.
Yeah, Americans taking their mobile phone numbers with them, that does make sense, to be fair, but American number plates, where your number plates are associated with you rather than with the car, that's odd.
Yeah, I guess so, because, like, what if you have multiple cars? Do you have the same number plate on all of the cars?
I don't know, actually. I assume not. I assume you have multiple number plates registered to you, I guess. I don't know. Because then they become attached to a particular car, but then when you sell that car, you keep the number plates and put them on your next car.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
That seems odd. That seems just like an inefficient way to do it.
Yeah, I mean, it identifies the car, right? Doesn't it identify the person driving it, or
that's the purpose of it, isn't it? Number plates are associated with a vehicle, and then the vehicle registry tells you who owns the vehicle.
Do you know in the UK you can actually look up a registration number and you can find out if it's taxed or MOT'd, and what kind of car it is? Yeah. There's a decent amount of information publicly available just from a car's number plate alone.
I guess that's why people blur their. Have you ever thought with the idea of proprietizing a language? It's not a new thing, but I heard about it recently. There was a court case. Some people made a Star Trek fan fiction film, and they had spoken Klingon in it.
And okay.
Paramount sued them on the basis that they own the Klingon language. I think the law is something along the lines of you can't copyright a language, but I think it says a useful language.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah, something like that. But one of the arguments in court was that they can copyright Klingon because it's not a useful language. It's not a useful language because there are no Klingons you can talk to because Klingons don't exist. That was an argument in court, which I think is fucking hilarious.
I gotta be honest, it seems a bit wild to me, just the idea of copywriting making noises. Like, you can't make the, like, it's, to me it's the same idea of like, because you,
very particular noises,
very particular noises, you know, like
music would come under that. And I'm anti-copyright in general, but I understand how music is something you can copyright, but language is a step up from that, isn't it? It's the concept of attaching meaning.
Hang on a minute. But the thing is, right, so just because we're against copyright doesn't necessarily mean that we're against musicians being paid, just as a side note there, because that's usually No. But, like, does humming a song, does that infringe copyright? What if you hum it in front of, five people or 10 people? What if you're on a building site? Is that a place of work? Do you need a license to hum a song?
I mean, definitely not a lawyer, so don't take this as legal advice, but I think humming would maybe count as a derivative word. No, because you can perform. You can perform. It's playing a recording, isn't it? It's the particular...
Oh, no. So a cappella is, I think, free of copyright if I'm, again, not a lawyer, but like... So I think a cappella is a... Yeah.
Hang on, or... do you, in order to perform a... No, if you perform a song, you don't have to... license anything, do you? Like, Hamish performs music live, and he performs existing songs. He's not, like, if he's going to perform, you know, straight out of Compton, as I assume he often does, I assume he's not going to go to whoever owns, you know, and needs a license to perform that live, surely.
I think you do. I think,
I could possibly be right. I'm saying that in I don't know.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you go to a festival, you can't just get up there and start playing. Okay, so I've got gov.uk. Alongside copyright, there are separate protections offered to performers known as performers' rights. These provide several rights for performers in relation to their performances. A performer can be anyone who acts, sings, delivers, plays in, etc. A recording of a performance is released when it is first published, right? Sometimes performers will want to prevent certain uses of their performances. Performers, no, this is performers' rights. This is the wrong one. Oh fuck! I'm bored.
Okay, this is the US, and this is somebody on Reddit who seems to know what they're talking about, right? So in a song, there will be separate copyrights in the sound recording, the lyrics, and the music. It's entirely possible that there will be separate copyrights within those. If, for example, someone licensed some music or lyrics from their own lyrics or music. These are often owned by different people, particularly the sound recording owned by the record producer versus the lyrics and music owned by the composer and lyricist. So if a musician wants to cover a song, then they only need permission from the copyright owner of the lyrics and music. Where if they use a sample, they need permission from the owner of the recording copyright as well. So it is all copyrighted.
I've got this one here.
If you're performing a song, you need permission from the copyright holder.
Okay, I got one here from gov.uk. Is permission always required to perform live music in public? If you do not own the copyright in the music and lyrics you intend to perform, in most circumstances, permission will be required from the copyright owners for live performances of music, provided that the venue you are performing in has an up-to-date public performance license from PRS. Then, in almost all cases, no further action is necessary in order to perform them.
They get like a bulk permission to.
It is the responsibility of the venue. I mean, to be fair, the fact that there's still odd rules around this is still like a bit mind blowing to me. It's like, right, you cannot make these kind of noises in this kind of way in a public place.
I know there's actually a point where it does become whatever. But like, if it's a family Christmas and you've got a big family and you've got 30 people around and I put a DVD on, is that at what point do I need a license to, you know, I'm doing a, what's it called when you show a film?
A broadcast. Screening?
A screening, I guess. Like, 'cause if I was to do it in the community centre,
yeah,
it's like a community cinema thing. Like, I would clearly need a license from whoever to, yeah.
Yeah.
But where's the cutoff point? I'm sure there is one defined in law, but it's silly.
Yeah. Is it a private party? But then if you do it at the golf club, which is a private venue,
yeah.
Then you presumably still need a license to show the sport and everything like that.
I think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it feels kind of a bit like the lawyers have won here a bit, right?
Well, the corporations have won. The lawyers have become the tools of the corporation. Like, lawyers are good because they are what gives people access to the law.
Okay.
But the problem is that the corporations don't. Yeah. I think we mentioned this before, but the idea that America is, like, particularly litigious now is actually bullshit. Like, back in the 18th and 19th centuries, way more litigious, way more lawsuits.
Mm.
And it was normal, like, middle-class people suing each other for infringements of the law, you know, civil law, which is good. Giving people access to the law is good. The idea that lawyers are bad, I think, is a bit of corporate propaganda in itself.
Yeah, I heard that.
They go, no, don't use lawyers. Lawyers are awful. And then they have all the lawyers.
Yeah. Like, wasn't there the woman that sued McDonald's because the coffee was too hot? And, like, they spread that as look at this, frivolous lawsuits.
Yeah. You know what they do in that circumstance, like?
What's that?
They've worked out that, I can't remember the exact details, but it's something along these lines. McDonald's have worked out that it's cheaper to pay the people who are injured by their coffee than to make the coffee less hot. It costs them more to make the coffee less hot than to just pay people when it hurts them.
Really?
Yeah. They've just made a calculation.
I mean, I know that when I do the coffees, we have a temperature by which we have to serve them at. So because, like, we can only make coffees above a certain temperature if they ask for it above a certain temperature. Otherwise, it's like...
Yeah.
But then again, like, if you get a latte, which is... There is an expected temperature at which a latte is served. If if you do spill it on yourself, you shouldn't really burn yourself. It'd not be nice, but like...
The worst times when I burn myself is when I microwave something. Because if something's too hot from the kettle, you feel it before it touches your lips, right? It's the steam and you feel the radiation. But when you heat something in the microwave, it has the properties of something that's not hot. And you can't tell to... touches your lips and then it touches your lips and immense pain.
I had that horrible thing where I made a bolognese sauce that was really good, like I fucking nailed it, but it was so hot, and I'm like, and you kind of got to hold yourself back a little bit, and then you just end up burning the inside of your mouth.
Incredibly frustrating. Yeah, waiting for food to cool down is when you're hungry and it looks delicious and smells delicious and you've got to wait. Mm. Horrible feeling.
Yeah. Oh, Christ. Oh, one thing, just because like this is going to be a shorter freebooters than usual. Did we say that at the beginning? Because you said something, like Ghosty said something funny. He goes, what, a freebooters? Less than an hour? What is this, a YouTube short?
Yeah.
So, we had this conversation off camera, but I kind of want to revisit Andor because we have recently both finished Andor.
Well, I do want to talk about that, but hang on one second before we move on, because I just had a thought. Did you see the Nick Clegg thing recently?
Oh my God, no, but I've heard people on Fedi talking about something to do with Nick Clegg.
Yeah, okay, so Nick Clegg basically saying you can't apply copyrights to these AI companies because if you do,
their business
untenable, right? The idea that corporations shouldn't obey laws if they make the corporation not viable is an interesting position.
Yes, it's like
it goes on from what we were talking about. Like
like that almost strikes me as being like American libertarian. Like you can't have laws. How are people going to make money if you've got laws?
Yeah, you might. But this, I mean, if the lawmakers agree ultimately, then can't the mafia just go, well, you know, murder and drug trafficking and human trafficking laws shouldn't apply to us because it will make our business untenable.
Yeah.
Drug dealers, you know, I understand the law, but it makes my business untenable.
Yeah. How the hell are you going to sell drugs if drugs are illegal?
Yeah.
Completely untenable business.
Like, it's just absolute insanity. And somebody like, I mean, Nick Clegg is obviously a fucking idiot, but he's a prominent person.
A prominent idiot, yeah.
What the fuck does that say about where we are? It blew my mind to the point where I can't think about it. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. And I mean, from us as well, you know, I might expect that from the Americans. But, you know, yeah. I don't know. There's a sort of, I got to be honest, there's a bit of comfort in distancing us from Americans, but I don't entirely know how justified all of that is, really.
Like, yeah, no, we're this far apart. We enjoy that gap, but it's minuscule.
It does shrink, doesn't it? Yeah.
Andor. I would like to talk. We're talking about Andor.
Yeah. But also, I sometimes feel I'm a little bit too forgiving of the Lib. Like, you and Hamish fucking go in on the Lib Dems hard. And there's a part of me that always wants to be like giving them the benefit of the doubt, but that makes it really fucking hard.
It's the thing with the Lib Dems for me is that particular election when Labour was Blair, or strongly
Brown.
Blairite. I can't remember. It was Brown, wasn't it? Yeah, very very Blairite. I mean, Brown was all right, but at that point, you know, Labour were.
Hang on a minute. It wasn't. It wasn't Miliband, was it? Yeah, it's Miliband, Clegg.
Miliband, yeah.
And Cameron.
But at that point, it was Gulf War, all that stuff, Blairism. I'm like, I'm not voting Labour. Tories, I mean, here, it was the choice between the three, Labour, Tories, or the Lib Dems. I was like, fuck it, it's Nick Clegg. He seems, like, energetic and, like, you know, probably the more left of the three parties in that moment. Fuck it, I'll vote Lib Dem. And they went into coalition with the Tories. So for me, that was a betrayal of me, and I hate them, viscerally fucking hate them, and they can never undo that.
Do you ever feel that we missed, like, that Miliband wouldn't have been as bad as...
Yeah, I think Miliband would have been great, honestly.
Miliband would have been,
He was
one of those people, and it happens a lot with, like, decent people on the centre-left. They just get curtailed by their advisors. They listen to...
I will caveat that about Miliband being great. Miliband would have been great had he been able to follow his instincts rather than being reined in by the right of the party. Which probably wouldn't have happened anyway.
He probably would have been reined in by the right.
Part of the problem is he campaigned significantly to the right of where his personal politics were because of those advisors. You know, you need the centre-left logic. And then he saw Corbyn, he was like, fuck me, I should have done that.
Yeah, and I think now he's a bit more unapologetically on the left. Not like as left as we are, but like, you know.
No. But he's, yeah, for a mainstream politician, he's pretty good. Yeah.
But then he gets sidelined by Keir Starmer. And like, even people I know who don't follow cabinet politics are like, my God, like Ed Miliband's just being shunted aside by Keir Starmer. Like he's, you know.
Not to shortcut the conversation, but the Labour Party right now is a very right-wing party by British
very
standards.
Right, yeah.
So it's, of course he's going to be sidelined. Like how could they, you know, yeah.
Yeah, by even conservative standards, you know, he's...
It was the Tories recently. I don't follow domestic day-to-day politics very much, so this is vague, but it was the Tories recently who did some kind of motion about Israel being evil.
The fucking
Tories, not Labour. Yeah. What the fuck are we supposed to do?
Is that a little bit of freedom of being the opposition? You know, where you don't necessarily have to follow through on the consequences of what you say. So you could be a little bit more truthful.
A little bit of that, I think, and a little bit the tension between, you know, the I've mentioned this a lot, but the split within conservatism between global and provincial capital, because I think one of those, the more sort of like, because it's not even the One Nation type Tories, it's more like the I guess the libertarian leaning ones are just like, you know, we don't want to be involved in foreign conflicts and supporting blah blah blah.
Yeah. So, but well, kind of wild. I didn't pick that one up. No.
It was very vague. Just something I noticed. So that might be a little bit wrong. But
well, there we go. Anyway, so we've both watched Andor.
Yeah.
And you described it to me as the best thing they've done in Star Wars since the original trilogy.
Having watched it all now, I think it said something like that. But I think it's... Oh, there's so many layers to this, right? I was thinking about this the other day. So the original trilogy really are the kind of slop that I criticize now.
Yes. As in,
it's just pure entertainment. It's pure, you know, it's a narrative that doesn't really talk to or connect with anything outside of itself. It's just a straightforward fairy tale in space kind of yarn. Like what the Marvel films are now, kind of, in that you just watch them, you have a good time, like a roller coaster kind of thing, and then 5 minutes later, you're never going to think of that film ever again in your life. I mean, different because it was our childhood, but essentially that kind of media. Mm-hmm. So why do I give the Star Wars originals a pass, whereas I don't give the Marvel stuff a pass? And I think the reason is that was unusual back then. The form was interesting. Because 70s cinema was in, like, by the standards of mainstream cinema, I think 70s cinema was a high point for, like, highbrowness.
Yeah.
So this thing that was just a straightforward, like, how about we give a fairy tale the budget and treatment of a big feature film? That's an interesting idea. And it was an interesting idea. Now it's not. I think that's why I give that a pass. So that's a bit of context. more context is, you know, as a kid who grew up in the 70s and 80s, I loved Star Wars. Prequels came out, fucking hated them. Millennials love the prequels, but every millennial I've talked to who love the prequels, they love the prequels because they watch Clone Wars. And Clone Wars basically fixes a lot about the prequels. I've been trying to watch Clone Wars. It's hard to watch. It's very kiddie. But yeah, so there's that whole thing. Put that aside. And then the sequels came out, but by that time I didn't care. You know, I kind of hate Star Wars at this point. And then I watched Andor, and it fucking made me like Star Wars again.
Yeah.
And I hate that.
It's I always try and like pick out in Star Wars the bits I like I give Star Wars a bit of a pass on that, like, you know, wacky aliens, doesn't take the science at all seriously. You know, it's superficial watching for me in that regard. And I think the less seriously you take Star Wars, the more you can enjoy it. But with Andor, it took a few episodes to get into it. But as you said offline, it's because they had the confidence that they knew where the story was going.
Yeah. And they didn't do, and this is important. So original three Star Wars, that was Star Wars. And then the prequels came along and they were very different. And after the sequels, this is kind of like a Skyrim Oblivion thing. After the sequels came out, it kind of made me respect the prequels a bit more, because I think they failed entirely, but I think they were trying to do something different. They were trying to broaden out this universe, give it a bit more substance. And then the sequels came along, and the sequels are just, I said this in chat a while back, but they're literally just the floating signifiers of Star Wars just shoved in your face. So do you remember AT-ATs? Do you remember X-Wings? Do you remember TIE Fighters? And in the original films, all of those things meant something specific. You know, the TIE Fighter was just scary. It made a scary noise. It's a scary looking, you know, interesting looking, scary. Now they're just floating signifiers. That's all lost. That that is forgotten. They just are signifiers for Star Wars. So you shove them, in. And Andor, for the first, I think, three episodes, doesn't have an X-Wing, doesn't have a TIE fighter, doesn't have an AT-AT, doesn't have a fucking lightsaber, doesn't have a Jedi for the whole show, or lightsaber.
Yeah.
It's very much not doing that, and that made me respect it. So Andor is an actual good... And when a TIE fighter does turn up in Andor, it's fucking scary.
Yeah.
It's not an empty signifier. Like, you they're in that valley, aren't they? And the TIE fighter just screams across over there overhead, and it's terrifying again. And that's what you should feel when you see a TIE fighter, not just, oh, that's a Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like, they do mean also, like, you know, they do meaningful politics in, you know, like, Star Wars to me is fun when they, because, like, George Lucas, basically, he takes loads of other films and he puts them into Star Wars, but a Star Wars version of them. So, like, Mandalorian is Star Wars but cowboy. Ahsoka is like Star Wars but samurai. And Andor was a little bit like Star Wars but the French Resistance. You know, like, certainly in I kind of like that, even on the aesthetic point, you know, points of it as well. But it did ring very true to the sort of the films, sort of the Great Escape era, you know, when there was a lot of those kind of, like,
Well, it's terrifying as well. Like, it's a very tense show to watch. I know it's very well researched. Like, they actually, Shah keeps making this point. Like, they actually research what, you know, insurgent and rebel groups do and go through, and you know, it's very bleak. You know, when you know, situations where this person served us, have been heroic, they've heroically sacrificed their safety to bring us this information, but they've seen my face, so they've got to die.
Yeah.
And it's never like, it's never treated superficially in that, you know, somebody's like, no, we can't kill them, that's the wrong thing to do. It's just everybody's on board with that. Yeah, of course they've got to die, yeah.
Yeah.
It's very sort of realistic in that sense and gritty.
And they actually, proper die as well. Like, I mean...
Oh, yeah.
It's like, because in episode one, The Phantom Menace, right, Darth Maul gets cut in half and then falls down a giant hole. Like, you don't get that in Andor. You get, like, I think in one of the final episodes, oh, I don't know, is this too spoilery? Someone just gets basically their throat slashed on a park bench.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'm like, fuck, that was kind of like...
Yeah,
that's
there's nothing glorious about it. There's nothing heroic about it. It's just like blasted to the chest, pull the trigger, you're dead. It's the mundanity of it that makes it kind of shocking and scary. The mundanity of the functioning of the Empire as well. We've not really talked about this. I keep contextualizing rather than talking about the show itself. But the show itself is not only the best Star Wars thing I've seen for a while, it's the best TV show I've seen for a very long time, regardless of Star Wars or not.
I think so. And I mean, the mundanity of the, is it the ISB, the Imperial something Bureau, like how that worked and how that functioned was great. You know, how the corporate side of it was then taken over by, like, the fascist side of it. It's like, oh, look, you know, the capitalist waiver, bringing the fascists.
It just nails the kind of two things, but it nails just people, they're just doing their jobs. Like, they're just... Mm. They have a task to do. It's their job. They're doing that task to the best of their ability. And you find yourself, you know, the blonde ISB lady.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Dedra Mira, I think, yeah.
Yeah. All the acting is fucking top notch. Every single bit of acting. You know the main dude, Luther?
Luthen, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's an actor I've generally not enjoyed in other things, but in this, he's absolutely fucking like immaculate. He's so good.
It
turned me around on him as an actor. It's like, yeah. But no, there's moments where you find yourself like rooting for Dedra.
Yeah.
Especially in season one, you're like, oh, I hope she wins this situation and puts it over her supervisor. And then you're like, no, wait, I'm rooting for the fucking bastard.
But then, yeah, and it does.
They're human beings. That's the, you know,
They do make it a lot more human. When they do the stormtroopers, they don't have the helmets on. When a lot of the stormtroopers in Gorman, they're just unhelmeted stormtroopers. They're people, and that's
another thing that doesn't show up for three episodes. The stormtroopers as well, yeah.
Yeah, and when they do, they have a purpose. I think in the original Star Wars they tried to make the fascists particularly faceless. Here they've humanized everyone, good, bad, and everything else, you know.
It's a far more adult story, isn't it? In the story of the originals, the facelessness worked. They are just evil. They represent evil. Whereas in this, it's getting into what is that evil, what is the nature of that evil, and what is true and disturbing is that it's not like, you know, it's not like a cheaper show would have done. They're not coming in and doing genocides. They're not coming in and being, you know, just like pointlessly villainous, you know, for the joy of it. It's just the mundanity of the day-to-day crushing weight of this authoritarian nastiness.
And it's when they're talking about Gorman, mild spoilers ahead, but I don't think it will probably ruin anything because but basically, when they're talking about their establishment on Gorman, they're like, Gorman has a resource we need. Gorman loses. Yeah. That's just how it goes. You know, it's not as it like, yes, it's genocidal, but at the same time, it's for the purposes of capital, not the purposes of.
Exactly. Just, and I think that's an important connection as well. It's not pantomime evil.
No,
this is all in service of material, the material desires of capital, essentially. Yeah, it makes it actually. It's amazing that it's a. How is Disney making like the best breakdown of why capital? Because it makes it very clear capitalism is the problem.
Yeah,
you know, the fascist layer is instrumental, but it's capital that's the fucking problem. It makes that very clear.
Yeah, because they have almost the very solidified ideologies. It starts off with capitalism. Like the corporation people, and then the capitalism fails to serve capital effectively, and then the fascist comes in and be like,
it's literally putting on the screen, you know, what you always say, like fascism is capitalism's emergency mode.
Exactly, yeah, and that's kind of that's kind of it, you know.
Disney, like, Ghost, you know, have speculated that the person who made the show must have like some. Like hardcore blackmail information on all of the Disney CEOs or something to get this made as a Disney show. It's also, Ghosty found this out, it is the most expensive Star Wars thing that's ever been made.
Really?
It's more expensive than any of the movies or any of the other TV shows, yeah.
They don't use that much CGI, and that's probably why, I guess, right?
Why it's so, yeah, because there's lots of physical sets. And the sets are extensive, like that. What's that for Ferrix? That Ferrix set,
yeah,
with the streets and the bricks, and they've actually managed to make it look lived in, like a real place. And again, the places. It's not just this is the industrial planet, and here's some pipes and you know vents with smoke coming out to show that. It's showing that like it's an industrial planet. They've got mud and they've got metal. It seems, you know, so everything's made out of bricks. Everything fits that all, and you know that, you know, the clock tower with the dude. With it's almost like Morrowindish. It's a culture that makes sense as coming from these material conditions.
Yeah,
which so much better than anything Star Wars for so long.
Yeah, and even the stuff that intersects with like mainstream Star Wars, I think is done really quite well. Like Mon Mothma,
very well. Yeah,
she comes across as like a proper sympathetic liberal. Like that's
exactly. She's probably my favorite character in the show. She's really enjoyable because it's so real. Like a liberal, and a wealthy, you know, a very privileged, wealthy liberal, but who understands that oh fuck, this is actually, you know, this is bad. I've got to put myself on the line. I've got to actually fucking risk myself. This isn't about politics anymore. This is something,
And is it Princess Leia's father or adopted father Doesn't he stay in the Senate? Like, isn't he also is he like more of a holdout liberal or something like that?
I think he's more like, I think they're both in the same. Yeah, I can't remember what justification he uses for staying there, but it's.
Oh, it's like I could. Yeah, like he's
sacrificing himself potentially.
Maybe, yeah, or like at least he can actually do something there still. Mon Mothma's kind of burnt the. Burnt the bridges and everything. Which is, yeah, so I guess it's like, I guess the moral of the story with Mon Mothma is that liberals can be saved.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah, I mean, this is, again, I think it's a deeply Marxist show in that Marx believed that the bourgeois could be a revolutionary class under the right conditions, and these are those conditions.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Luther as well.
Yeah, really, Luther.
You know, he's bourgeois at this point. I know that's not his, you see, backstory later on, but at the point where the show starts, he's bourgeois.
He could do
quite well under the empire.
See, this is one of the things I always wonder about class theory, right? Is, like, Luthen seems to be more like masquerading as bourgeois.
Absolutely, yeah. That's why I brought up the backstory. But he is also materially, like, he's running, this shop is real. You know, he's running this shop. He's probably got, you know, a decent income. He could also be, you know, he could choose to go, fuck it, you know, I do quite well under the empire, fuck it.
So if you okay, say you start off humble background, you know, and then you accrue wealth and you masquerade as bourgeois, do you then become bourgeois, or are you still a faker? Like, at what point does the
You're a spy, essentially, aren't you? I mean, he was masquerading. The real Luthen was not that bourgeois persona.
No, but what I mean is, but like, is it basically what I'm thinking? The question I'm asking is about class mobility. Does it? Does it like, because if you look at like class system in the UK, there's a lot of things in place to stop class mobility, right? Like a lot of it around. What we call public schools, but private schools and all that kind of stuff. And even within schools, there are distinctions that maintain the class system. But if you can fake it, I guess there are books written about this, aren't there? And a lot of things like mused about this, but like, it's faking it until you make it. In America, they have the new money thing. That's a bit more like,
I mean, there is class. I mean, as you say, there are barriers to it, but there is class mobility, and that's one aspect. If you do want to migrate classes, that's one of the things you have to do. Is fake it till you make it, I think. But that doesn't really, because I would say what I believe at least is the bourgeois are really working class. They're just slightly elevated working class, but they have the same vulnerabilities. Thrown to the lions when it's necessary.
Okay, so but not the aristocracy are the ones above the bourgeois then. Okay,
And one thing I like in the show shows that have a sort of left-leaning message often present it such that in order to care about this stuff, you have to have something in your past that made you care.
Yes.
Right. And it does do that with Andor and Luthen. They both were sort of party to the brutality of the Empire. I don't like that as a thing in general. The idea that only people who've been subject to this can care about it is kind of fucking nonsense. Because we have empathy. And so Andor also has characters that are quite comfortable, could just stay silent, shut up, they'll never be in danger. They can do quite well, but they still see that this is wrong, and they do something about it. Like, well, the ginger lad.
Or the cousin of Mon Mothma, who's played by the Waif in Game of Thrones. Like, she could just not be a character. She could just, you know, and then
Mon Mothma herself. She could just follow the rules. Yeah, yeah. So there's lots of people who've not been subject to it who, just out of fucking solidarity, we can say empathy, but what it comes down to is just solidarity with other fucking human beings, can care about things without it being always tied to personal, you know, lived experience. It's not all about that.
So I don't know. Yeah, 10 out of 10. I don't know. I don't know how. Yeah, whatever. I've got to go to work now. So shorter Space Virgin, not Space Virgins. We need to do Space Virgins. I watched the episode, by the way.
We need to do Space Virgins, yeah. Partly so we can get through the expanse and get onto whatever we do next.
Yeah, I've got some great ideas. But basically every episode should just be, I don't know.
How many of your great ideas are the Human Centipede?
Only three of them. But I have several. I have dozens of ideas. So that's, yeah. Anyway, right. I'm gonna close it off now. Yeah. But thank you all for joining us on this PeerTube exclusive.
And on PeerTube Shorts.
On PeerTube. Yeah. Oh yeah. Toodaloo.